My name's Ed Piskor.
I'm Jim Rugg.
And we're going to be digging into a very cool Eastman and Laird interview from Amazing Heroes. But first, what do you got, Jimmy?
I have patreon.com/JimRugg, where I post lots of original art, process, comics, everything you would expect from a cartoonist Patreon. And right now I'm doing a series where I compare and contrast Street Angel Lost Dog, my first Image comic, even though it did not end up being published, and Street Angel's Dog, which was published as their Free Comic Book Day. 3 years separate these two comics, but same story, totally different cartoonist, even though it's both me, in terms of experience and just, you know, my ideas on how to tell a story well. So if you're interested in craft and process, it's a really good series to hop on, and you can find that at patreon.com/JimRugg.
Red Room issue 1 and 2 are available for pre-order. As of this recording, thousands of people have put in their reservations for issue 1 through the Fantagraphics website. You can now do so for the second issue as well. Hit my link tree up in the description below this video, and you'll find the links to take you there. If you want to read the comics ahead of time, both of these issues are available on my Patreon to read ahead of time. $3 will get you the archive. There's nearly 100 pages of stuff on the Patreon so far, and new strips come out every Tuesday. So Jimmy, Amazing Heroes issue 107. This is in 1986.
It is indeed.
And this is November 1986. This interview is incredible because nobody knows what's in store. You have some idea that Eastman and Laird know that there's some things on the horizon that they can't quite talk about, but let's jump into this thing because it is a great snapshot.
Let me stop you for 1 second. 2 points for everybody watching at home. We have a video that's 1986 Amazing Heroes where we go through the entire run from that year. I say it all the time, 86, an amazing, magical year for comics. Amazing Heroes, a really cool magazine for those reasons. Some of the highlights and things that are mentioned in the news and advertisements throughout this issue include Mage 15, Matt Wagner wrapping up that independent comic classic. Xenozoic Tales by Mark Schultz being announced by Kitchen Sink. This is much earlier than I thought for that particular book. Dead World, Vince Locke, before it even gets to Caliber, but it's announced in the news section. And you had started with this issue open. I think it's worth calling attention to where the Turtles were at this time. First Comics is starting to do their new color graphic novel series, which is discussed in this interview. But we've talked about this several times, and I think it's a big deal, man. Bookstore distribution of Turtles.
It's early enough that it ain't no series. It's a new graphic novel.
Good point.
Because if this imagery right here is timely to the article, here's what Eastman and Laird are working on in this image. This is the cover for Michelangelo number 1 from the Micro series. This is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 7 cover. So they didn't even hit their pinnacle yet, which would have been issue 8 with the Cerebus crossover. There's not even a mention of that. So this is before issue freaking 8 of TMNT, and the charm that's in here and sort of like, these guys are the darlings of independent comics.
It's so good to say it and to frame it that way, because you are right. Like, it's incredible how successful they are, and this is before they're successful at all. When you think about the success they achieve, and yet, like, they're really high up on the mountain of success at this point, and it's not even a glimmer of what's to come.
Everything that is kind of surrounding the success is all comic related. So this is Mark Waid is the editor of this issue. And the way that he frames it is not only are they successful at what they're doing, they are the absolute most successful independent comic out there. There's not a close second, and it even rivals some Marvel DC books. So that's the level that these guys are operating at right now.
I could do like an hour probably on this illustration.
Oh, it's so good.
It is awesome. It's cool to see like the Xenomorph big like this. And this is before Dark Horse has that license. You know, like, talk about shades of things to come in comics. It's a happy accident, but boy, that one's pretty spot on.
Kevin Eastman using the airbrush.
Yeah, man.
Powered by a turtle. We see Opus on the shelf there. You could see the stuff that would be, like, Eastman stuff and Laird stuff, I feel like.
Yeah, Flaming Carrot on the wall in the background. The Thing on a shelf in the background. Really cool stuff. Wonder how much of this stuff, too, is accurate. You know, like, I'm sure they had, like, knickknacks and art and different things on their walls. Pretty fun.
Yeah, so, you know, we could launch right into this. When you talk about you know, those comics, Xenozoic, Dead World being announced and not realizing that it was that early. I didn't realize that they met, Eastman and Laird met each other in 1972.
That does not make sense. Because Kevin Eastman, we interviewed him, he looked like he was my age, which doesn't make sense at all because I wasn't even born in 1972. And that guy's like meeting his business partner and art partner.
And they won't really solidify any major work together until the 80s, pretty much, man. Like, printing little bits of nonsense here and there, but nothing very seriously.
You know, one more piece for timing. This is the height of the black and white explosion. When we talk about black and white explosion, this is probably the peak year. We did an episode on all the Turtle knockoffs. Those are all 1986. That's all this year. So, you know, Turtles show up in 84. 2 years later, you can just see it. It's a seismic shift in the market, all based on the Turtles' appearance in 84. And 86 is probably the peak of that seismic shift.
They are the darlings, man, of comics, right? Like, but I do love the ethics of Gary and Kim. Like, you ain't getting an interview in Comics Journal, man. You're going to get an interview in Amazing Heroes, and it's going to be like 10 pages with a lot of images, yeah. Man. You can read this interview in 5 minutes.
If you want to blow $8 million on Tundra, you can come and talk about your bookkeeping with the Comics Journal.
So these boys are the darlings, man, and they're very popular. So the interviewer asks the question that they've heard a fucking million times. Tell us about the evolution of the Turtles. And Eastman's like, is it your turn, Pete?
Yes.
They're like, yeah, we oscillate back and forth between who's the one who tells the story. And we know the story. Like, they shared space together, man. They made comics hanging out. Peter Laird draws a turtle with a nunchuck. Eastman likes it, draws another turtle. They're having fun. They like the idea. Get a little bit of tax refund money. Not quite enough to print up enough copies. Go knock on Uncle Quentin's door. They kind of get into that a little bit deeper, where they approached Uncle Quentin like a business, you know, with a specific kind of goal in mind. And Uncle Quentin sort of bought what they were selling, gave them 700 bones, and that was enough to print up 3,000 copies.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff here. Not their first effort. Fugitoid was their first.
And
I think that's kind of cool to see that part of the, you know, they tried and it didn't work. It's not like you can just stamp this out. There was lightning in a bottle with Turtles. You know, it was different and people recognized it and clung to it, but it didn't come overnight.
No. There's a couple things. Like, the Fugitoid book, you can get that. So I encourage you to do that. It's a cool thing to have, to see what their earlier efforts look like. Also, there's that comic called Gobbledygook that publishes their individual efforts from, like, weird zines and stuff like that. So you get to see pure Eastman artwork, pure Peter Laird artwork without the dual hands in the mix there, man. So definitely seek those books out if you could find them for a good price. But the black and white boom comes because there were 3,000 copies of that first issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and very rapidly. They talk about even going to conventions and feeling weird that people were selling them for $30.
Yeah.
And at this point, as of this interview, the price for that first issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is $125, and they use the word speculative and speculators. I think that thing's about $5,000-$6,000 now.
It may be more than that. And, you know, I don't collect high-end books,
no.
You know, or collector's items, but I was thinking after reading this, like, this would be a book I'd want. Like, this is a book that is very special in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it has that significance. So, yeah, all of that stuff is real interesting to me. There's another piece here referring to the beginning, and it's like people ask them, why is it the oversize? And they explain, like, that's a mistake. They took a sample to the printer of a magazine that they had, and they're like, you know, this is it, glossy cover, newsprint inside. But it wasn't a comic book, and the printer printed their comic at that size. Like, they didn't even think about the size. They just assumed comic book size. And when they got it back, it was that oversized magazine size. So you hear these things, too, like lots of, you know, I won't call that a happy accident.
It speaks to the naivete, because
yes.
I don't know about you, Jimmy, but if I'm printing a comic book, and I want it to look like a comic book, I don't think I would take TV facts to them. I think I would take a comic book and say, can you do this?
That does make sense.
When you lay it out like that, Ed, I was ready to defend them, but you make a strong argument. Especially because at the time, the stuff was all newsprint. You know, it's not like
they're fanboys. So I imagine them like pushing a bunch of comics out of the way. We need to figure out, like, we need to speak the language of the printer. Get those commandies out of here. Like, where's my TV facts book?
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's good stuff.
They do the advertisement in the comic book buyer's guide. The orders start to trickle in. Their idea was, you know, we got these comics and we hand-to-hand ship these things, man, to people who place these orders. What started to happen at this time, though, there were multiple distributors out there, and they saw that ad. They might have gotten some inquiries from stores or whatever, and they started working with distributors. And it was early enough that they thought they were going to call the shots with what the distribution discounts were going to be. Frankly, I like this piece because it shows at least some self-respect and some savvy. Like, what would a typical SPX cartoonist do? Like, John Porcellino, like, does some distribution, and there were times when he talked about, like, people were their cover price is like less than it cost them to print it.
Yeah.
So I mean, these are the geniuses that you're working with in comics a lot of times.
Yeah, I've had friends talk about like pricing their books, and it's like, well, you need to know what it costs to make it. These aren't arbitrary prices. And, you know, conversely, I see people complain about books that are expensive, and it's sort of like, these aren't arbitrary prices.
Right.
You know, it's you're stuck with cost. Like, that's what dictates these prices. There's a formula. And, it's fun, man. It really is fun seeing these guys learn through this step by step through this process. You know, the distributor thing's a big one, of course.
First print run, 3,000. Second print run, 6,000.
And they went immediately back to press with that second print run using the money that had come from the first print run, which is a lesson that I think a lot of cartoonists could learn from, because I know guys who, they sort of are successful in that they sell out their book, or they, you know, they sell it well, but they're not earmarking that money for the next book.
Yeah.
They get to the next issue and it's like they need the money again for the printing. And it's like, the business model has to be, if you sell out of that first one, that's the nest egg. That's the going forward for the reprint, for the next print, for the next issue.
For like my personal formula, it's like a third, a third, and a third. So like with the WYSIWYG stuff, it cost like $5 a piece, print on demand, you know, 100 pages. Sold it for 20 online. So $5 would cover the shipping, $5 for the printing. The $10 is there. It's like, you let me keep five.
Five for you, five for Uncle Sam. As an independent contractor, a third of it, you know, figure, earmark that third.
Yes.
Or self-employed, I should say, not...
Which is an even bigger tax burden.
Yeah.
Trust me. So we mentioned the speculators earlier, right? And how these comics are expensive. They were pretty early in keeping everything in print. I think you got a fifth printing of TMNT1.
Yeah, the cover illustration to this interview has the fourth printing cover, one of the pieces of art in the background.
And that's one of the things that they would do. They would add extra value to all their reprints and stuff, man. If it's not just an editorial piece, like, there might be a Richard Corbin story.
New covers.
Right.
New art, yeah.
Yeah, and even in the first comics color reprint, there were 20 pages of fresh comics just for that edition. That's something that cartoonists still don't do to this day, when they just package up a book into TPB and might just have a couple of sketches or something in the back, if anything.
I want to get into their collaborative process, because I think that's really interesting for Mirage Studios. But one last note on this kind of like intro of what they're doing in their background is working full time.
Yeah.
You know, whenever they're creating these first couple of issues, they both have 40-hour-a-week jobs. That's the reality too. You know, I had a 45-hour-a-week job for the first 7 years I made comics that wasn't making comics, you know. That's independent cartoonists, you know. You got to figure out a way to keep the lights on. So it's kind of cool to read about guys who are super successful and still, you know, what are they, a year removed maybe from quitting that job, year and a half.
The question is asked, when did you know that this was a success? They said around issue 2, because the initial print orders at that point, 15,000 copies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great moment, too, whenever you can be like, you know, I think
I think this is where we take the chance.
You got to take the chance, man. Everybody's entitled to take the chance.
So the next bit is, you know, a lot of these questions do feel like these are the questions everybody must ask them. How do you two collaborate exactly? And they get into it, you know, and they write, they do thumbnails. You know, some of that stuff's broken up a little bit. I think Eastman does a lot of the thumbnailing. Mm-hmm. They conceive of the stories together. They pass them back and forth, though, eventually with, you know, about half of us on each page. And I like that, and I think it's really cool, and I think it extends whenever you see, like, Mirage expand and you see these other artists come in, because you'll see Talbot and Eastman on a story. You know, Bissett shows up and is creating a character with them. I feel like this collaborative thing is something that grew out of those two and then became bigger as Mirage was running, but still had that spirit of collaboration. And you see a lot of good cartoonists come through there and work on these books, these early issues. And as they get busy and pulled away from creating themselves, you still have this group that's there, and it seems to have similar energy.
This is the interview where I discovered what those weird lines are on those black and white books, man.
Big
where the mention of the brand name is Kraft Tint, and Roy Crane used it on the Buzz Sawyer comic strips, and Frank Miller would use it here and there, man, just describing the chemical process. We did two videos fairly recently about the process, and I was very happy that a lot of people in the audience were very honest and were like, I had no idea how that was done. This is magic. Thank you so much. That's how I felt like reading this piece, you know, and before the internet, you had to cobble this information by any means necessary. And I had no illustrators in my life. I don't know that you could have even bought this stuff in town. Actually, Gary Sassman hit us up. It was like, you know what? I was going to Art Institute at the time. There was a store called such and such, and you could get it. So that's cool. Color story in the back of issue 7. So that's the cover that they were working on in that illustration. So I guess that issue would be out as of this interview, but that's the one that had this Richard Corbin color piece.
I feel like this is the moment whenever you guys know you're successful. When Richard Corbin is collaborating with you, that's got to be incredible.
Eastman has a long career of this, and he says it right here, like how it was a important thing, a personal fantasy for me, you know? So, you know, he's got a couple of dollars to throw around now, and he can commission the cartoonist that he likes a lot to make a comic and draw his characters.
Yeah, that part of their legacy, I think, is something that often doesn't get discussed enough. But, I mean, those guys really were patrons for artists, both of them, and doing it very differently.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, that's their greatest legacy, truly, in the history of comics. It's funny when they start asking these very, very specific art-driven questions. Like, I care less about that.
I do like whenever they ask about film and they get into like VCR talk and video rentals, just because it's a snapshot. I mean, that's my nostalgia there, but it's fun to hear those guys talking about that, you know, and I just picture a couple of dudes sitting around on the couch, drawing their comics, you know, on lap boards and watching whatever VHS movie the other one brought home that night.
This is, when we start talking business, this is where it's like so quaint and you want to just like travel back in time and just like let these guys know, like, you don't even know what you're in for yet. When the interviewer is asking the question, how do you coordinate handling both the business and the artistic end of Mirage? What they're talking about is, like, coordinating Comic-Con schedules and that kind of stuff. It's barely licensing. The licensing stuff that's out there, role-playing game.
Which was, like, a surprise hit.
Yes. Yes. The cool thing about it being a surprise hit, you can find that shit.
Yeah.
And there's artwork, and it's duotone artwork of very cool stuff that you don't see anywhere else. It's the Dark Horse little pewter figures, and
which
it's not
super weird.
Yeah, and it's not Mike Richardson Dark Horse. It's like some New England wargaming kind of company that would make, you know, horses and stuff. So that would fit into the role-playing aspect. That's where it makes sense, because there would be that sort of thing. And there's like a beautiful little piece in here where they're like, it was amazing seeing our guys in 3D. It's like, you don't know. You want to shake them.
Yeah.
You don't know what's about to happen to you.
It's incredible. Solson, they're licensing their characters to other publishers. So the first comics collection, and they even say like they're excited for it's going to be in B. Dalton bookstores and Walden bookstores. And then Solson licenses like how to draw the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but also like the martial arts manuals with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I laugh because Solson, man, what a shitty publisher.
I know.
You talk about the spectrum. We licensed out the Turtles to two comics publishers. One of them is First, and we get these beautiful color graphic novels in bookstores.
Yeah.
And the other one is Solson. It's almost toilet paper. The one thing I pulled from the licensing, though, that I thought was, who knows, maybe dumb luck, maybe they got a good lawyer, whatever, but they get final approval on everything. And I feel like that's a magic phrase in what they are going to be coming into over the next several years after this interview, is having somehow retaining as much creative control as they do. It's really interesting to me, that part of it, because you see it be organic. We've had a million people call us about deals, and you listen to them and you think about it and whatever, but this idea of like, I need to keep this, like whatever deal we're making, this is what I have to have out of it. Because you don't know what the scale of these deals are. You know, like most of them don't amount to a television show or a syndicated television show. You just know, I'm working with people I don't know. Let me protect my interests. And, you know, obviously with the Turtles, it worked out. But you could see how it would organically grow.
Totally. This piece right here with Eastman in regards to the business stuff, it's worth reading. The business is real interesting. We're learning on both ends, helping each other along the way. We've learned how to deal with distributors, do shows, organize things, along with how to do the books more easily and which systems work better. Right now, we're probably as efficient as we've been. We've hired a business coordinator, young woman, blah, blah, blah. She's organized us, helped keep us on track. Like, it's just comic-related stuff. They're the fucking darlings of independent comics. Another piece that they talk about is doing like Munden's Bar strips and like all these other, there's that Shell Shock trade paperback that collects 20, 30 short stories of the Ninja Turtles that just showed up. They would hotshot books for people. When Gary gets in trouble and Fantagraphics gets sued and they produce Anything Goes, first Fantagraphics comic I ever bought was like issue 3 with the Turtles cover and an 8-page silent story. Or excuse me, wordless story in the thing. They did that for nothing. And I bought it because of the Turtles. I bet a lot of people bought it because of the Turtles. So they're all over the place.
Let me read the next line, Ed. The interviewer asks, does the business ever interfere with your art? Oh, oh yeah. There's a lot of stuff to keep track of. That's the other part. And we've talked about this in the past, is just like how, you know, they get so successful that they don't get to draw anymore. Just no time. It's all the business part. And you can see it right there. It's starting, you know, it's heading in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. The cool thing is, man, if Seven just came out, and there's no mention of Cerebus in here whatsoever. So I have to imagine that's not there. They're still going to do maybe 6-7 issue, half dozen issues together,
right,
and then do their single issues. So they still get to be cartoonists for another year or two. But when that cartoon comes out, man, the wheels come off, baby. They're business men now.
Yeah, it's such a fun history, like going through this for that reason, you know.
Somebody makes that zine, or they do that collection of the editorials from the inside front covers of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comics. This is an interview to keep to put in there as a companion piece, because it's that same thing where you see the acceleration of the popularity. I think it's Raphael number one. You would put this right after Raphael number one, or you put this right before Raphael number one, because Raphael, that's the one where they're like, guys, we could talk about this now. It's going to be a cartoon.
And how.
And I think it was that thing, it's going to be a cartoon, it's in syndication, that means you should probably like call your local station, get them to cover it, because yes, it'll be in New York, it'll be in L.A., but it might not be in Spokane, you know?
That's one of my favorite editorials of any comics thing I've ever read.
It's amazing. Yeah, and this is one of those great interviews, man. I was seeking this exact kind of interview out when I found this mag. Like, I wanted to read an interview with these guys just before the stuff broke and just see where their headspace was.
That's the way to position this interview for, you know, spreading the word about it, is like, this probably is one of the last interviews before all of that just goes, like, I don't, you know, into another level, like inconceivable.
Right. Amazing, man. We've documented their history quite a bit here. We got to do a little shoot interview piece, man, with Kevin Eastman, and had to dust this off when I was digging through the bins, man, and just highlight this issue of Amazing Heroes for that exact reason. Issue number 107, December 1986.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a snapshot of a certain time. It's really interesting to see, like, the architects of the black and white explosion in the midst of that black and white explosion. And it's interesting to think, like, that's a collapse. You know, this is the other thing. You cut to 2 years from now, and it's like the black and white explosion has completely imploded. And meanwhile, the turtles have gone supernova.
Right.
It's real funny to think of that. You know, as close as they are to that black and white explosion, they're also above and outside of it. And continue to be that there.
Yeah, they address the parody comics
a
little bit.
First one's flattering, and then another one, and then another one.
Yeah, and it just gets boring. And they've created this system where all these stores are cropping up. There's enough stores to support almost any black and white book because nobody wants to miss out on the next possible Ninja Turtles. Like, that's how this whole thing happened. So what are people doing with this amazing opportunity? They're making more wannabe Ninja Turtles comics. Fucking dildos.
Yeah. Yeah, you really miss the memo when you think of what is the Turtles' success. A book that didn't look like anything else.
It's such goofball nonsense, man. But they do talk about the books they like, and because it is 1986, Cerebus, Watchmen, Dark Knight, Love and Rockets shows up in here too.
Yeah, Swamp Thing. It's your usual suspects. And they single out Nat Rat for all of the parodies as being, like, that's a really good comic. You know, speaking to Mark Martin's abilities as a cartoonist. And we know that's true. I mean, they end up working with Mark Martin a lot. Kevin Eastman does in the years after this. So
Mark Martin will be the first, if my memory serves correct, he will be the first non-Eastman and Laird issue after they take their powder and go do business things, man. It's Mark Martin stuff.
It is fun to see the names that get thrown out. Obviously, Frank Miller, Jack Kirby, you know, kind of people that you would expect. Barry Windsor-Smith, Conan's is someone they reference as, you know, influential and somebody they like. Jim Shooter's name is thrown out here at one point. Although they kind of say, you know, would either of you work for Marvel if Shooter called you? It's an interesting question at this point, like, you know, pre their biggest licensing deals. And, you know, they're kind of lukewarm, let's say. You know, they have attachment to some of those characters, but also, like, think of what they're doing. You know, they're in a dream seat, and I think they recognize it.
Oh, totally. Totally.
That's cool.
It really is, man. And this last little soapbox piece, man, they get into the give Kirby back his art kind of thing.
Yeah, very timely for 1986, a big campaign at that point, a big public battle between Marvel and the Kirby family. I think one thing that we haven't said yet is there is a certain storyline with cartoonists and American comic book history, and it is exploitation, and it is beaten down, and, you know, bitter is something that comes up a lot, bad endings. It's incredible to read this stuff because of how refreshing it is. Like, they didn't pay those dues. They worked hard, I'm sure, to get to this point. They took chances. They had books not work like Fugitoid. But this is a totally different perspective on comics and what comics could be. I mean, this is the dream shit for every cartoonist that follows them, I think. When I found these kinds of, you know, their story,
yeah,
my whole what I wanted to do in comics changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're really the poster children for that alternative, for that thing of, like, make your books, own your books, and you can do this. It's amazing. It's a different, it's a very refreshing point of view. That could have kept them out of the Comics Journal interview seat for a while, I think.
Total American dream story, total, like, lottery strike. And, you know, even as it sort of ends, you see Eastman's naivete where he's talking about, like, how, you know, there are all these shops popping up and I don't see them stopping the growth of the market and stuff. You know, we'll see in the year.
Yeah, that part changes too. Like I said, that black and white explosion that's on fire at the moment of this interview. Well, this is the peak for that.
Yes, sir, man. Fun stuff.
I love it.
You good to go?
I am.
All right, kayfabers. Like, follow, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Hit the bell. We'll notify you when new vids are available. What do you got, Jimmy?
Patreon.com/JimRugg, where you can see my own creator-owned comics and in the process behind making those, lots of original art and all the stuff you come to love in, like my Octobriana Process zine. You can get lots more of it at patreon.com/JimRugg.
Red Room issue 1 and 2 are available for pre-order from the amazing Heroes Publishers, Fantagraphics. You could get to their website by way of my link tree in the description below this video. Thousands of people have reserved issue 1 of Red Room. Let's boost those numbers up for issue 2 now that you know about it. You can read the comics at the Patreon, patreon.com/EdPiskor. New strips go up every Tuesday, and those first two issues are up there right now as we speak.
You can subscribe to the Cartoonist Kayfabe e-newsletter at the links below this video to keep up with everything we have going on, our own little Eastman and Laird-like operation.
That's
here.
That's goddamn right.
Big plans for 2021. Keep up with all of them at that link below this video. You can also find Cartoonist Kayfabe t-shirts and merchandise at the links below this video.
Jimmy, give him another set of marching orders, and we're going to be on our way.
Read more comics.